Okay, good morning, everybody. This is about 2:31. It's Wednesday, August 31st. And it's a noteworthy class because why? It's noteworthy because what's happening next time? Yeah, you have a test, right? You got a test next time. So no lecture next time. All right, that's great. But what is on the test? Chapters 1, chapters 2, chapter 4, and chapter 5. All right, so that's what's on the test. And how do you prepare for that test? The study guide is all important because it tells you what chapter, it tells you what chapters, but even more importantly, what pages within each chapter. Some chapters you only have to read a little bit of. And then it tells you what the exam figures are. Remember, I can photocopy some of those exam figures, erase the labels just like they are in the study guide, put on the test, and then there'll be a word bank, and then you have to do matching with some figures. So, knowing the relationship to structures, and then there are word questions, maybe some true-false, other kinds of matching, and those you can find at the end of the chapter in your textbook, but I also give you some online question banks as well. So, I might lift some of those questions out of the end of the chapter or from the online questions and put those on the test too. So, the more familiar you are with all that stuff, the better off you're going to be. Okay, so any of that material is really good to look at. All right, any other questions? Oh, I got a couple other comments to say, but any questions regarding the material so far? I think everybody is doing good with the online quizzes. What's the deadline for your online quizzes? Oh, it was last night. Yeah, last night, 11. Hope nobody forgot. I didn't check to see if anybody forgot, but I think you guys are doing pretty good with those online quizzes. One of the ways, and I can't fix this programming, one of the features of Blackboard that I really do not like is that when you go into a weekly assignment, there are a number of pages, and the weekly online quiz is always the very last page. Maybe it's page 6 of all the weekly assignments. And when you click on page 6, either by hitting the forward arrow or by hitting the navigation frame on the left-hand side that takes you to page 6, it automatically opens up a window for the quiz. And it bypasses the instructions on taking the quiz. And I really hate that. I can't program Blackboard any other way. So when you get that window and it says click begin to start the quiz, you don't necessarily have to take the quiz. Don't hit begin. But don't arrow back either. Hit the X button at the top of the page, just close that window out, and then what appears at the same time is the window which contains the instructions, like what's on the quiz and that kind of stuff. I think if you hit the back button or do something different, it puts a little paper symbol in your gradebook. And then I have to go and clear that out manually. So that's a little bit of a hassle for Blackboard at the moment. Yeah. Okay. Maybe it depends on the browser that you're using, the version of the browser. I'm not sure what it depends on. I can't figure it out. So if it doesn't go to the quiz page exact, I'm really happy to hear that. But if you're using a computer where it jumps automatically to the quiz, just X out of that window. And even if it puts a zero in for that quiz, that's okay. Because why? You can take the quizzes an unlimited number of times. But I think once you get that paper symbol in your gradebook, that's what's always going to show. I mean, it'll record all the other quizzes that you take, but I got to clear that one out. It can't get past that little glitch. So if you get a paper symbol, I'll eventually clear it out and you can see the grades that you got. Maybe you can't see them all. I can see all your quizzes. Maybe you only see the highest one that gets graded in there. All right, so that's good. So what's important for the test? There's a video on my website that covers the integument system. And you have some webcasts in Blackboard that have the three videos for the integumentary system. And let's see what else. I think that's probably the important webcasts and fancy things that are on the internet. All right, the last topics that we're talking about in terms of the integumentary system. As a matter of fact, what is the integumentary system? What is it made of? Skin and? Yep, and what do we call hair? Generally, it's a what kind of structure? Accessory structure. Right, so yeah, you're right, so the integument is skin plus, I would say more generally, accessory structures, like examples would be hair, nails, glands, muscle, some nerves, right, so that's what's in skin. And what are some main functions of skin? Probably the two most important. Protection, yeah, protection. And protection I break down into two categories. Protect you from infection and dehydration, right? Those are the most acute functions that the skin is performing. If those break down, then you can get into trouble right away. All right, some other things about the skin, some aging of the skin. Last time, I think we finished by saying what is the most damaging thing you can do to your skin? Sunlight, that's right, sunlight. Even if you don't burn your skin, just going out in sunlight. And what feature of skin protects you from sunlight? There's a cell, and then give me the name of the chemical that cell makes. A melanocyte, and it produces melanin. Where do you find that? What layer? The general layer. Where are melanocytes found? As a matter of fact, let's step back a second. What are the two main layers of skin? Superficial one is epidermis and dermis. So where are melanocytes found? Epidermis or dermis? Epidermis. And then, of course, you got to break down the epidermis into layers too. What layer of the epidermis are melanocytes found in? They're the stratum basale. They're the living layer, the deepest layer, right? They're close to oxygen and nutrients. Okay, so skin aging is mostly due to being out in the sun, and it damages blood vessels, right? And when you don't have blood vessels, that means your skin can't get oxygen and nutrients, and the blood can't carry away toxic compounds and waste products that build up in the skin. So what happens as you start to lose blood vessels in the skin? Well, the skin becomes thinner and more transparent, right? That's just because it doesn't have the same amount of oxygen and nutrients, right? And then there are cells that make collagen. What are those cells? Fibroblasts, and those you find in the dermis, both in the papillary layer and the reticular layer. And as those cells run out of nutrients and oxygen, they can't make as much collagen, they can't make as much elastic fibers, so that means skin is more easily damaged when that happens, right? If there's not the same amount of collagen in there, that happens as we get older. And as those fibroblasts can't make elastic tissues, what happens to our skin? Well, it just gets more saggy as we get older. It's just the way, and wrinkled, because those elastic fibers can't pull the skin back together again. And furthermore, when the skin is damaged, those fibroblasts are necessary to repair the damage. Since they don't have all the nutrients that they're used to having, your skin doesn't heal quite as fast either, right? So that's just a couple of things with regard to aging, all right? And then the blood vessels also carry heat around in your body. So when you're overheating, it can carry heat from the interior parts of your body to your skin, where you can radiate it off. Or when sweat evaporates from your body, it takes a lot of heat with it. But if your blood vessels are decreased, they can't carry heat from the deep parts of your body to your skin to release it to the environment. So as you get older, you have poor temperature regulation as a result of that. So that's an age-related effect of the skin. And whenever there's a heat wave, right, they tell people to stay inside maybe, not exercise outside, especially who? The elderly people, and of course young people as well, but the elderly, they always mention that. That's very important. I know France and Spain, Portugal, a couple of years ago had a really tremendous heat wave for about a week and a half, and maybe this year too, but back then I remember that in Europe, just in that period of time of about a week, about almost 10,000 people died of overheating, of heat stroke. I was just floored. I couldn't imagine why that was, you know, and it was especially what? The elderly. And has anybody ever lived in Europe? What happens in August, July and August? Nobody goes to work. It's just everybody goes on vacation, right? Everybody takes off, including doctors in the hospital. And when you take off, usually you leave your grandparents at home. So everybody left down to the Mediterranean to swim in the ocean, right, and left their grandparents at home, no hospitals, and this big heat wave hit. And a lot of people's grandparents just cooked because no one was there to take care of them. And it's really amazing that that happened. Okay. you might have some spots, like age spots, right? Your skin might turn colors a little bit differently because of different number of melanocytes, their activity changes, right? And also an accessory structure like hair. What happens to the color of your hair as we get older? Right, the melanocytes in the hair follicle stop doing their job quite as efficiently because they run out of blood supply, and not as much melanin is incorporated into the hair as it's developing. So our hair turns white or gray or silver depending on various kinds of factors. All right, so those are some age-related effects. So you should know the names of some of these cells, what their contribution is to your skin, and what happens when that contribution disappears. Okay, again, so for instance, a person with albinism, what's the underlying cell that's not doing the job there? Yeah, the melanocytes, and those melanocytes are producing melanin, right? So just develop a little understanding of what's going on inside the skin. Okay, so that's it for skin. So now we're going to move on to the next chapter and the next topic, and that's just a general lecture on bone tissues, skeletal tissues. Is this material on the test? It is not on the test, right? But we put the test off because this week was practicum week, right? So otherwise we would have had a test today. Okay, so that test is going to be 1 week from today, but not including this material right here. All right, so here we see a skeleton. You see a little bit of an outline of the soft tissues inside your body, but these are all the things that make up skeletal tissue. And the things that make up skeletal tissue, is there a way I can get both of these on the same page? Well, this slide will work. Okay, but the next one won't. Okay, but there are three things that make up the skeletal system. Of course, there are bones. Okay, here we have a bunch of bones, and in lab we're going to start to look at the axial skeleton after your practicum, which includes the skull, vertebral column, and the rib cage. That's the axial skeleton, as opposed to the appendicular skeleton, which are the bones that make up the appendages, like the upper arm. I mean, like the upper appendage, which is the arm typically, and then the legs down over here. Right, but not just bones, but also cartilage. And you studied three different kinds of cartilage already in the tissues. And the cartilages you see are highlighted in blue and maybe orange and red in different locations on the skeleton. That's an important part of the skeletal system. And then there's one last thing that's made out of dense regular connective tissue, and that is some bones are held together very tightly, like the joints within the head. There is dense regular connective tissue between the two bones that prevent bones within the skull from moving, except for one, or between two. There's one joint that actually does move, right? But the immovable joints in the head are held together by dense regular connective tissue. And a bone-to-bone connection is called a ligament, right? So components of the skeletal system are cartilage, bone, and ligament. So we're going to look at some of these things. All right, what about functions? Well, bone, in particular, is very rigid and it's strong. It's not compressible, so that means it can hold up a lot of weight. It can't get squished, right? But if you overdo it, of course, a bone can break, but that's with a great amount of force. Right? Cartilage, on the other hand, can take a shape, it can hold a form, but it's firm. But the big difference there, cartilage is flexible to some degree, so it can bend, and some cartilage is more bendable than others. So if you have cartilage with a certain kind of fiber in it, it's really bendable so that when you let go, it goes back to its original shape. What kind of cartilage is that? Elastic cartilage, yeah, connective tissue. So as a matter of fact, all these components that make the skeletal system are what? Connective tissues. Each one of these are different connective tissues. Okay. So some examples of places where you have cartilage is in the nose, ear, rib cage, and also during development. You have a lot of cartilage. And when I say development, what does development mean? As opposed to congenital. Development means how your body changes and grows. Most bones, okay, develop from little models of what the bone should look like, and that little model is actually made out of cartilage first. And then it becomes bone through a process that we call ossification. So a precursor, a model of bone is made from cartilage first in a lot of cases. All right, another function is protection. Like the skull protects the, what's up there? Your brain. Yeah, okay. And I'm really glad I have a nice big hard skull, because otherwise I probably wouldn't have been here, because I've hit my head so many times doing fun things. Right, the skull really does protect the brain. Rib cage, the ribs, what do they protect? Yeah, they protect. Which I need to leave a little bit of it out. Here's the rib cage. All these vital organs, like the heart and lungs, right, are protected by the rib cage. It's not a big armor plating like the skull because it has to move in order for you to breathe a little bit. So it's a little bit more mobile. And the other protection, vertebral column. Sure, the vertebral column protects not the brain but the spinal cord, which is nervous tissue, which is relatively delicate, so it has this nice armor plating around it to protect it as well. Okay, another function of bones is for movement. All right, so bones are also for support, right, so to kind of support your whole body, and your body can move because the bones can move. And what moves a bone are muscles that are attached to it. So when a muscle contracts, it's going to pull a couple bones together, and these bones are held together via joints or articulations. And so bones can move across a joint because a muscle pulls on it. Okay, ligaments, on the other hand, are a bone-to-bone connection. And ligaments typically prevent motion between neighboring bones. They hold these bones together relatively tightly so they don't move. For instance, like the joints in the skull, which we call sutures. Your head doesn't change shape very much when you're thinking or breathing, okay? Unless you're a Martian, you saw that on TV programs and things like that. Their head wiggles back and forth. But that's just science fiction. People's heads don't wiggle back and forth because there are ligaments, strong ligaments between those bones. All right, another important function is storage. So what does a bone store? And before you took this class, you'd probably say, well, calcium, right? Because you need to have calcium in your diet to have strong bones. But even more importantly, you don't need calcium to make a strong bone, but it's a reservoir for calcium. All right, so you need calcium in other parts of your body, and when you're running low on calcium in your diet, guess what? Your body can go to bones to get calcium so that the other parts of your body aren't depleted of calcium. So it's a storage form of calcium. But in order to make a strong bone, not only do you need calcium, you need phosphate. Right, and we just call that inorganic phosphate. It has some complexes with this oxygen molecule right here that will make a very strong matrix that's incompressible, make a nice strong bone. And then there's something else that's stored in bone, just like in the hypodermis. There can be a lot of adipocytes in hollow spaces inside bones, and adipose tissue is just an energy storage. It's like a big battery, can store a lot of energy. And then lastly, bones are very important because they're hematopoietic. That means that that is the site for blood cell production. And we mentioned in here about how many red blood cells die in your body every second? Hundreds, thousands, or millions? Millions, that's right. So what kind of tissue do you need to build all those red blood cells back? You need good, healthy bones because that's the place where red blood cells are made. And that process of building red blood cells is called hemopoiesis. Right? So bone is a hemopoietic tissue because it makes red blood cells and platelets and other kinds of blood products. All right, so here's the question. Oh, I highlighted it. What is a hemopoietic tissue? It's a tissue that does what? Makes red blood cells. What's another name for a red blood cell? Yeah, erythrocyte. Really good. All right, so here we have cartilage as well. Cartilage is a it's the first kind of part of the skeletal system that we're going to look at. Okay, so hyaline cartilage is glass-like. It doesn't have many fibers. You have ground substance. It's very translucent. Right, and you have chondrocytes and those lacunae. Chondrocytes are just the cartilage cells. It does have some fibers, but they're not very big. They're submicroscopic. You can't see them with a light microscope. They're also soluble, right, in the ground substance, so you can't see them. So it's a special soluble kind of collagen, unlike what you find in dense regular connective tissue. And the places where you find hyaline cartilage is in the nose, right, and also joints that are freely movable. This kind of cartilage will cover the ends of bones that are articulating with each other. Also ribs, the costal cartilages, the larynx, which is your voice box right here, has hyaline cartilage in it, and the trachea, which is your windpipe, has some rings of cartilage or C-shaped cartilages to hold the windpipe open. All right, so this kind of cartilage you shouldn't bend very much because it doesn't have elastic fibers. So here you see the location. right? Joints, all movable joints have hyaline cartilage if they're a healthy joint, if they're not arthritic, right? The nose, and then these costal cartilages right here that come off the ends of ribs that attach it to the sternum right here. These are hyaline cartilage. Another kind, elastic, right? We see in the ear right here. There is, right above the trachea, there's something called the larynx, and one cartilage of the larynx is moving back and forth all the time. It's a trapdoor, so that it opens up when you're breathing, and the trapdoor closes when you swallow something, so when you swallow, that food doesn't go into your lungs, and it goes into your esophagus instead, and those two tubes are right next to each other. So what do you call it when you swallow something and that little trapdoor doesn't close over the windpipe? Okay, and when you swallow, food goes into the windpipe instead of your esophagus, which, that would be choking. That's right. Okay, choking is bad. Can't live when you're choking. You can choke to death. And the other thing is, when you're choking, you can't speak. So it's very common sign language. It's accepted, well-understood sign language. When you're choking, you can't speak, but how do you tell somebody you're choking and you're going to die in just a couple minutes? Yeah, you can do all kinds of things if you don't know, but the usual symbol is take your two hands like this, right? And so anybody that's educated in CPR knows that you're about to die. That's your last cry for help, even though you can't make a single sound. And they know what to do for you. What could you do for a person like that? Heimlich maneuver, that's right. When we get to the respiratory system, maybe we'll talk about that a little bit. That's a special cartilage up over here. It's called the epiglottis. It's elastic cartilage. It flops around all the time. Usually behaves, but not guaranteed. You could think about this, you guys that are CPR certified. There's a day of the week where the epiglottis does not like to work. It gets lazy. And there is a time during that day. Yeah, Sunday, because Monday is coming. That's not the answer I was looking for, to give you some feedback. And there's a time during that day as well. So think about that. So when we get the respiratory system, you won't be blindsided by that. What about fibrocartilage? What kind of cartilage is that in terms of strength of these three kinds right here? That's the strongest because it's loaded with collagen fibers. So it resists compression to a greater degree than hyaline and elastic. And also it can't be stretched quite as much. So it can reduce these two kinds of forces right here. Compression is what? Squeezing. What about tension? Tension resists the opposite motion, which is pulling apart. Right? So not all tissues can do that, but fibrocartilage does a good job. Okay, bone can do a good job. If it was just calcium, could do a good job at one of those, but terrible at the other. Bone can resist compression very nicely if it just has calcium in it, but if it's just like calcium and you start to pull it, it will fracture into a million pieces if it just had calcium. So it's got to have other things in there to resist both compression and tension at the same time. All right, and that kind of tells you that. In that kind of bone, then you have fibers like collagen. I'll mention that again. Some more. All right, so here's a pretty good example of where you find these different cartilages at. Here's that larynx, right? And the epiglottis is right here. Here's that little elastic cartilage, and that flops down over the opening to the air pipe right here when you swallow something. Usually that happens. Here's some nice micrographs that you're familiar with already, right, of the different kinds of cartilages. All right, on this slide right here, we see shapes of bones, bones by shape. We could classify bones as either being a long bone, right? So a long bone means that in one dimension, it's very large, and then the other two dimensions, like left and right, and then forwards and back, all right, it's a very short dimension. So there's one dimension that is very large, and the other two are small. So here is a typical kind of long bone. It doesn't necessarily mean that a long bone is always long, because you can have a little bone, really, really short bone here in the tip of your finger, right? But still, it is, from superior to inferior, very long, but from side to side, right to left, it's very short, and then from anterior to posterior, it's very short. So it's still a long bone, even though it is short, okay? All right, now a short bone is going to be short no matter how you look at it, like bones in the ankles would be some short bones, or maybe the wrist. So all the dimensions of the bone are going to be exactly the same. And it so happens that it's a very small kind of bone. Another bone that's not on the diagram right here is a sesamoid bone. Sesamoid bones are kind of interesting. Maybe you have a couple normally that form in your body. But a sesamoid bone is one that forms completely within a tendon. All right, so it's completely surrounded by dense regular connective tissue. So there's a tendon that connects the muscles in your thigh down to the bone in your leg down over here. And that tendon goes right through this bone. That's called a sesamoid bone, and this bone is the patella. There's another sesamoid bone in your thumb, and you can have other sesamoid bones develop in tendons, maybe even ligaments in your body, and those are due to like repetitive use injury, right, or stress in a particular joint that isn't being used properly. All right, so sesamoid bones can develop through a pathological process, but here is an example of one that's a normal, healthy sesamoid bone to have, and that is the patella. Other bones are irregular. All right, so here I see a big massive part with some projections sticking superiorly and then posteriorly and inferiorly, and there's notches all over the place on this bone. This is what we call an irregular. This is a vertebrae. Okay? And you can see the vertebral column is made out of these irregular vertebrae. And some bones are what we call flat. All right, so flat bone almost looks like a long bone. All right, but in maybe the left to right dimension, it's fairly large, but it's thin. Right, so this is a flat bone. Some other flat bones make up the cranium, but a flat bone doesn't necessarily mean it has to be like a tabletop. It just means that it's kind of thin, even though it has curvature, like bones that make up the cranium. Those are still what we call flat bones. But a really good example for your mind would be the sternum right here. Okay, parts of a long bone. Let's look at a long bone. All right, so here's a long bone. This is the one in your arm as opposed to this part of your body. What's this part of your body called between your elbow and your wrist? Is that your arm? That's not your arm, that's your forearm. So when I say arm in anatomy specifically, it's what? Right between your shoulder and your elbow. Here it is, your humerus. All right, so we're going to look at that in particular. The ends of a long bone, like here and here, are what we call the epiphyses. All right, epiphyses. Right here and right here. Here's the proximal epiphysis. Here's the distal epiphysis. Proximal means what? It's closer to some center attachment point to your body. Distal means it's farther away from that center attachment point. Right? The epiphyses are covered with hyaline cartilage because it forms movable joints. Right? Nice hyaline cartilage right there. That's the weakest kind. And maybe in your mind you have a picture of what it looks like. The diaphysis of a long bone is just the shaft. So from about here to maybe about here, this whole part of a long bone is the diaphysis. Or you could call it the shaft, but the answer on a test would be what? Diaphysis. All right, and so there's going to be a line between the diaphysis and, well, the epiphysis, but usually we find it in the epiphysis. There's the irregular. Let me flip through these really fast. Okay, and let's look at this picture right here, which is the next slide. All right, so here is the proximal epiphysis. Here's the distal epiphysis. And when we look inside this bone, if we cut it open, we can see some bone that's really solid, like I see solid bone right here. And if we look in this region, we see that it's filled with cavities. Maybe with, you could even call that a sinus. All right, and so this looks like a sponge. So guess what we call that? Spongy bone. All right? It can have some different names because these are made out of plates. Sometimes we call it cancellous bone, right? And these bony plates are what we call trabeculae, so it's also called trabecular bone. So spongy, trabecular, cancellous all means the same thing. I wish everybody in the world could just agree on what? One term, all right? But we can't all do that. All right, so you got to know all those three names. As opposed to the solid bone right here, we call that compact bone. It doesn't have trabeculae, doesn't have spaces in between it. It's just solid bone. And so sometimes it's called dense, sometimes it's called habergen, and even more times than not, it's called cortical bone. All right, so let's talk about this bone right here, a little bit bigger picture. This right here is an organ. A bone is an organ. It's alive, it has living cells in it. And it's an organ because it has connective tissue, it's got nervous tissue in there, right? And so it's composed of many different kinds of tissue, so it's an organ. And an organ has can be broken down into two main regions, the superficial part, which is on the surface, and the deep part. Usually there's a big difference in organs, depending on what's superficial and what's deep. So superficial and deep have two special words associated with it. Superficial is, the superficial part of an organ is the cortex of the organ, and the deep part of the organ is the medulla. Okay, like the adrenal gland has the adrenal cortex and adrenal medulla. And the adrenal medulla is which part, the deep part or the superficial part? It's going to be the deep part, right? So where I have the cursor right now, that's the medullary part of the bone, which is either spongy bone or this big cavity that you see right here. And so we call that the what? The medullary cavity. The medullary cavity is not lost. There's always something in there. The two kinds of things that could be in this cavity, when you're undergoing development, when you're growing, it's filled with red bone marrow. So marrow is going to be in this cortical, this medullary space right here. And there are two kinds. Red bone marrow makes red blood cells, right? It's a hemopoietic tissue. But as we grow older, this medullary cavity is replaced. Instead of red bone marrow, right, it's replaced with adipose tissue. So it's another storage form of energy inside your body, so the space is not lost. So where would you find bone marrow? What part of the bone? The medullary cavity, right there. And depending on what age you are, it could be red bone marrow or yellow bone marrow. All just depends. And all of us in here, it's yellow bone marrow a long time ago. Okay, and here you can see some compact bone or haversian bone, or by the layer of the bone it is, we could also call this cortical bone. And a lot of times we refer to this as cortical bone, even though we know it's compact. Right, so cortical is real important, as opposed to what? Medullary bone, which is cancellous or trabecular or however you want to talk about it. All right, so here is the line of demarcation between the epiphysis and the diaphysis. And notice that it has a solid appearance right here. And it will have a nice solid appearance, and it's filled with compact bone. I wouldn't call it cortical bone because it's no longer on the cortex, but it's still compact bone. In the adult, but in the developing individual, like the child, it's not going to be bone. It's going to be cartilage. Okay, so here is a cartilaginous plate. There's going to be another one down over here. We would call that the epiphyseal plate. Remember, it's like a three-dimensional structure which is made out of cartilage. So in your mind, which is stronger? Is bone stronger or is cartilage stronger? Bone is a lot stronger, okay? So this is an area that can be damaged pretty easily for a youngster because it's made out of cartilage. So if somebody's swinging on a swing, like I'm sure we all used to do, swing really, really high, and what is really super fun when you're swinging really high? Well, jump off, and you go flying through the air, and it's great fun, but it always ends. It could end in disaster. What happens? Well, you got to land, and landing is never really fun, but flying is great. Landing is not so good. And when you land, you put a lot of axial compression on the bone, and maybe the bone survives just fine, but what about this cartilaginous plate like right here? It can be compressed, right, and it can damage those chondrocytes in there. And the job of this epiphyseal plate in the developing individual is for bone growth in the long dimension, right? So this epiphyseal plate is important for bone growth. And if it's damaged, maybe an individual, when they fly off the swing, damages just the bones in their left leg, but not their right leg, guess what happens? Then one leg is going to be shorter than the other, and you need a lift in a shoe, right, so that you have an easier time walking later in life. So this bone right here, this epiphyseal plate, is easily damaged, and you have to be careful with that with youngsters. Okay, another example might be with little kids that like to play Little League, which is a little hard ball. It's not like softball, it's a hard ball, and you got to throw the ball really fast if you're a pitcher, right, to strike out the batter in the batter's box. And if you're young, it's okay if you learn how to throw fastballs, which is what? Just thrown straight. You don't really damage the epiphyseal plate, but if you're trying to throw a fancy pitch that's going to curve, does anybody know what you have to do with a baseball to get it to curve? You got to put spin on it. You got to have rotation. So that means you got to twist the ball as you're throwing it. You got to twist it really, really hard. And that twisting motion can damage these epiphyseal plates in a developing individual, right? And so people in Little League, little guys in Little League, women in little women in Little League are taught not to what? Throw curveballs, sliders, things like that. Just what? Fastballs. Okay, because of what? This epiphyseal plate. Don't want to damage that. Okay, some other things. There are some membranes on this long bone right here. There's a membrane that surrounds the bone on the outside, and that's what we call the periosteum. Peri means surrounding. There's a membrane that lines every little cavity on the inside, and that's what we call the endosteum. Right? Endo meaning inside, peri meaning surrounding on the outside of a bone. So we got periosteum, endosteum right here. Let's see, what did I forget? I got some other pictures of these things right here. Okay, let me go back to the previous slide. We're doing pretty good with the long bone. Let's look at this area right here. And maybe that's a couple slides up. Yeah. Okay, so this is really nice because here I see the, this is on the joint. So this is the articular cartilage. Between the articular cartilage and bone, you're going to have the periosteum, which I don't really see on this slide. But I see the membrane lining every cavity on the inside of the bone. That's the endosteum. And I see the two kinds of bones. I see spongy or trabecular or cancellous bone here, which is what? Deep, so it's medullary. Then I also see cortical bone. What's the structure of cortical bone? It's compact or solid. That would be a way to talk about it. And the other thing that you notice with this compact bone right here is now you begin to see some circles developing. We call those lamellae. All right, so let's see if I can find a picture of these lamellae someplace. Okay, here's a pretty good picture. All right, so here's just like a little quarter section, kind of shown in three dimensions. All right, so these are what we call concentric lamellae, because they just surround each other, concentric lamellae. Here's the endosteum. This hole in this structure is called the central canal or haversian canal, and it contains blood vessels, both arteries, veins, as well as nerves. And then here is the matrix of the connective tissue, which is filled with both collagen as well as the calcium and phosphate. And then here are these little pits or holes within the matrix that hold the osteocytes. So these are mature bone cells. And these different, so this little hole right here is called what? A lacunae. Inside the lacunae are the osteocytes, and these lacunae communicate with each other through these little tiny canals, which are called canaliculi, and that allows oxygen and nutrients to diffuse from the blood into this cell, and then into this layer, and then into this layer right here, because bone is solid. Things can't diffuse. Nutrients can't move right through bone except for these little canaliculi right here. All right, so don't forget a bone cell. So an osteocyte is a mature bone cell. Let's see what other kind of picture I have. Here's a good one. Let's look at this one right here. All right, so here is the micrograph that you're used to looking at, just in two dimensions. Here's that central canal with the blood vessels and nerve. And then here are the concentric lamellae. And this gives bone a tremendous amount of strength, right? If you're going to build a structure that's long to make it strong, it's in the form of a tube, right? Just a nice circular tube means that it's very strong for compression. And a really strange engineering concept is that if you have a tube, what makes it strong, okay, is the wall thickness. So if you have a tube and you want to make it really strong for compression, how thick should you make the wall of the tube? This is a really strange concept. The thicker you make the wall of the tube, the weaker the tube gets to compression. The thinner the section of the tube, the stronger the tube gets, which is really, really strange, at least toward compression, not from blows from the side. So if you want to make a really strong tube, it's got to be a thin wall. So what does bone do? Bone is thick, but it's made up of what? Really thin tubes. So one lamellae is a tube, and what's on the outside? Another thin tube. Okay, and what's on the outside of that? Another thin tube. So if you layer together a bunch of really thin tubes, bone is almost incompressible. You can't compress it. And then furthermore, if we look at bone, you're going to see that even on the outside of all of these things, there's more tubes that surround the bone, and those are what we call circumferential lamellae. All right, so bones are what? Tubes within side tubes, which make them incompressible. The calcium also makes it incompressible. But what do you do with bones besides trying to compress them? You twist them and you stretch them, and bones would fall apart if it weren't for something else that's inside of it. Okay? And I think I probably have that on this slide right here. Okay? The things that make bones, bones, are both organic and inorganic components. The inorganic components would be like the calcium and the phosphate that we mentioned. We call that hydroxyapatite. It makes this kind of chemical formula right here. They're just put together, and you see it's got some phosphate and some hydroxyl groups right here. You don't have to really know this chemical compound, but you should at least know in this class that bones are strong because not only does it have calcium, it has what in there? Phosphate, right? You can't make phosphate. You need to have that in your diet, just like you can't make calcium. Where do you get calcium from? Your diet as well, right? So you need to have both of these in your diet. So the inorganic components in bone provides for hardness and it resists crushing or compression. Right, so I do want you to know what an inorganic component is, and it resists compression. But we do other things to bones. We twist them, right, and we stretch them. There's got to be another component in there, and that is that familiar fiber, and that is collagen. All right, so collagen what? Resists tension. You can't stretch it. So bone has, in between the lamellae right here, collagen fibers. So it resists stretching, and it's arranged in a really special kind of way. Let's take a look at how collagen is put between the lamellae. All right, so here is an illustration of bone, and here you can see the concentric lamellae, tubes with inside tubes. And in this outer layer, look, the collagen kind of goes as we go from bottom to top, from left to right. And when we get to the next inner lamellae, what's the orientation of the collagen fibers? It goes the other way, like 90 degrees, right? And then what about the next lamellae? Again, 90 degrees to the one on the outside. So these different layers have collagen fibers that are overlapping but in different directions. What does that remind you of? Obviously, it reminds you of plywood, okay? Because how do you manufacture plywood? Wood has a grain to it, right? In order to make strong plywood, would you put all the layers in plywood with the same grain orientation? Oh, because then it could break. But if the orientation is different and they're glued together, that makes plywood really, really strong. Okay, what else does that? You know, bones do that, but what else? Tires are made that way too. There are belts, there are fibers, metal fibers within tires, right? And the layers are oriented how? So the fibers never are the same orientation. Those are the belts within a tire, which makes a tire really, really strong. So these collagen fibers don't resist compression, right? If you have a fiber, you can compress it very easily, but what does a fiber resist? Tension, okay? And if it's in this arrangement right here in layers oriented opposite, it also resists twisting. All right, so bone is fantastic because it can resist compression, it can resist stretching, and it can resist twisting all at the same time because it has all of these different components in here. All right, so I want you to know stretching is what we call tension, twisting is what we call torsion, and crushing is what we call compression. And you should know which components in a bone resist each of those three different kinds of forces, okay, and whether they're organic or inorganic. Okay, so here's a really good test, right? What components of bone resist torsion? It's the organic component, which is collagen, which for compression is the calcium and phosphate, yeah, the hydroxyapatite, calcium phosphate. And what about tension? That goes back to your familiar collagen fiber, okay? And, you know, concrete like that pillar right there is pretty much sort of like your bone. Concrete is really good for resisting compression, just like calcium. But if you start to stretch concrete, guess what? Or twist it, it breaks into powder, right? But what's in that column to resist twisting and stretching? There's something in there? Yeah, there's fibers in there, metal fibers that we call rebar, right? So kind of use those models a little bit. All right, so microscopic structures of bone, those rings inside rings. And the best picture your book has right now, I guess, is this thing right here, right? So sometimes we call this the haversion system or an osteon, right? This is what gives compact bone its strength, this osteon. It's just all the different lamellae right, and the osteocytes that maintain it. So in order to understand compact bone, you should know this structure right here, everything that we talked about, the concentric lamellae, the collagen fibers. So if I were to ask you, what's the building block of compact bone, what would you say? What's the building block? Kind of a complicated structure, but if you know that complicated structure, you'd know the beauty of compact bone. You would say the osteon or haversian system. All right, so bones have hundreds of these osteons all the way on the outside. That's what makes bone really strong. All right, so you make sure you know concentric lamella, central canal. Ah, Volkmann's canals. I didn't show you that. There are other canals in bone. Let's see if it's over here. I don't see it. It's got to be... got to be someplace. Where could it be? Here's a pretty good example. All right, so here's a central canal. Here's another central canal with a blood vessel, okay, aligned with the long axis of the cell. But here is another canal. Can you see it transverse right here? This is what we call a Volkmann's canal or perforating canal. It can take blood vessels from right to left within a bone, not just from cranial to caudal direction, but from right to left. So here's a perforating canal. All right. And what about canaliculi? Where are those? Those are between the lacunae, right, within compact bone. All right, so I do want you to know what the structural and functional unit of compact bone is, and that is what? The osteon, and know these different components of the osteon. All right, let's talk about bone growth and formation a little bit. There are two main ways that a bone can grow. All right, and one way is called endochondrial ossification. And when you see this term chondrial right here, or chondro, what are you going to think? Cartilage, right? So here is one kind of ossification, and ossification just means bone growth or bone development. So this kind of bone development happens within cartilage, right? So in this particular case, shape of the bone is first made out of cartilage, and then the cartilage turns into bone through this process of ossification. That's one kind. Other kinds of bones are made by intramembranous ossification, which means that the bone is first modeled or outlined with a membrane, not cartilage, but a membrane, and then that membrane, which is a flat sheet, is ossified. It turns into solid bone. And flat bones develop from intramembranous ossification, like flat bones in the skull, are formed with membranes, right? And then they ossify later on in life. As a matter of fact, newborns don't have completely formed bones that make up the cranium, and they only have membranes in certain parts of their skull because they haven't ossified yet. And what is stronger, bone or a membrane? Bone is a lot stronger, right? And so those spots within an infant's brain that are still membrane can be damaged very easily, and they're called fontanelles. And in lab, you got to know the names of some fontanelles within the skull. And let's see if I can find some here. You know what? I think I have them in the axial chapter, but here is x-ray of maybe almost a newborn, and I can see a fontanelle here, and I can see a fontanelle here, and a fontanelle up over here. And these fontanelles can exist in an individual up to 2 years. So one has to be very careful with these youngsters. Not only are they susceptible to puncture wounds, but also vibration or any kind of twisting motion. That's why you can never shake an infant either, because it can damage these fontanelles. Okay. Commonly they're just called soft spots. Endochondrial ossification happens with all other kinds of bones, with the exception of flat bones, like long bones or regular bones. Okay. The only exception to that is the clavicle. And where the heck is the clavicle? You don't know where the clavicle is, so let's look at the skeleton right here. All right, the clavicle is this long bone up here in the shoulder. It still, nonetheless, develops from intramembranous ossification, even though you would think that just like the humerus, which is a long bone, which develops by endochondrial ossification, the clavicle would do that. So that's an interesting exception. And that clavicle, when we look at bones, you're going to see is kind of an interesting bone. Okay, so endochondrial ossification, a model of the bone is made out of hyaline cartilage, not fibrocartilage, right? And then that cartilage model ossifies in stages. We got a couple stages, a primary ossification center and a secondary ossification center. The primary ossification centers are up in the epiphyses of the bone. Let's look at this nice picture right here. Okay, so what kind of ossification process is happening with this long bone right here? What is this bone primarily before it becomes bone? It's hyaline cartilage. So what kind of process is happening here? Intramembranous or endochondrial? Endochondrial ossification, right? The primary ossification center, okay, is along the diaphysis of the bone in a collar. Right, so here we see a bone collar developing, as well as the central part of the diaphysis starts to ossify. And then it grows and grows and grows. And at that time, right, there are cells that break the bone down that are on the inside to form this medullary cavity. But there are other cells that still build more bone, make the medullary cavity bigger. And it kind of uses up this hyaline cartilage model. It starts to fill up. Okay, and it fills up more and more and more. Right, you still have the bone collar and a nicely formed medullary cavity. And then later on, right, in the epiphyses, you have the secondary ossification center on the inside of the bone, which then starts to make spongy bone in the epiphyses, and then it grows, and then finally it bumps up against the primary ossification center on the diaphysis. And what are you left with? Nice hyaline cartilage between these two ossification centers, and that's what we call the epiphyseal plate. Okay, so there are a couple different kinds of cells that are working right here. In mature bone, like in compact bone over here, we just call them osteocytes, right? And they're inside lacunae. So an osteocyte lives in bone that is completely mature. It has formed a complete haversian system, and it's fine. Right, the kinds of bone cells that actually make bone during development are what we call osteoblasts. So osteoblasts make bone, and there are some bone cells that actually dissolve bone away in order to make this cavity right here. They have a little bit different name. They look a lot different, and they're called osteoclasts. So these are three names of cells you should be familiar with. In mature bone, like this cortical bone right here, you have osteocytes, cells that build bone, typically on the cortical surface right here, we call those osteoblasts, and the cells that break bone down on the inside of a bone are called osteoclasts. So in terms of the membranes within a bone, you should probably be able to identify where you find these cells. So what do we call this membrane on the outside of the bone? That's the periosteum. The periosteum contains cells that make bone. Those are the osteoblasts. The membrane that lines all the cavities on the inside of the bone right here, right? What do we call that membrane on the inside? Endosteum. The endosteum contains cells that break bone down to make sure that overall structure is tubular in nature, number one. But when it breaks bone down on the inside, guess what? It makes bone a lot lighter. We would have to eat a lot more every day if our bones were solid. I don't know how much heavier we'd be. Probably not twice as heavy as we are, but maybe close. It would take a lot more energy to move our skeleton around, so that's one way of making us lighter, more transportable, requires less energy intake. All right, but these cavities are also used for things, and you should be familiar with that, like red bone marrow and yellow bone marrow. Okay, so when you have bone that's growing on the outside, like we have right here, but is being depleted on the inside, we call that appositional bone growth, right? Because some cells are breaking bone down, some are building bone up. And what makes this bone grow in the proper proportion, the proper strength, and the proper size? It is, like if we were to put you on a spaceship and shoot you up into orbit, these bones wouldn't develop properly. Okay. What causes a bone to develop properly? Exercise or stress, right? So if you stress a bone, it gets bigger and stronger in the ways that protect the body from that kind of stress, right? So as a matter of fact, our bones are always being rebuilt. And the bones that you have in your body right now weren't there 5 years ago. Every 5 years, you get a new skeleton because of the activity between osteoblasts and osteoclasts. All right, so that also introduces another important concept in anatomy, but especially physiology. So here you have some cells that break bone down, the osteoclasts, and cells that build bone up. Those are the osteoblasts. What can you tell me about the activity of those two kinds of cells? Are they working together, or are they working against each other? It's kind of interesting because they're actually working against each other. One is building bone, one is breaking bone down, okay? But they're working together in the sense that with the activity of both, you end up with the bones that you need, the proper kinds of bones. If you only had cells in your body that build bones, what would happen to you? You would just be one big mass of bone, you probably couldn't even move, right? But because you have balance between these two different kinds of cells, we call that antagonism. And antagonism is a very important concept, probably the most important concept you can learn in anatomy or physiology class. Because when you have antagonistic control, two systems that work against each other, you have precise control and balance over an important function in your body. Okay, I'll mention that again in a little bit more detail when we get to the muscle system. How do you control your body perfectly with balance? Is because you have some muscles that maybe will flex at the elbow, but you also have muscles that extend. They're opposite motions. They're antagonistic to each other. But would you want just to have a muscle like the biceps that causes flexion without a muscle that causes extension? You wouldn't, because then you couldn't have control over your forearm. You could only just be hitting yourself in the face all the time. Okay. All right, so osteoclasts and osteoblasts are antagonistic to each other. But that just provides for important and control over bone growth. All right, so that process of rebuilding your bones all the time through the activity of osteoblasts and osteoclasts is what we call remodeling. And it's really important, okay, because that it's a process that happens all the time. If you stop using your skeleton, guess what kind of cell wins over? The activity starts to take over. That is the osteoclast. So if you don't exercise, what happens to your skeleton? It gets smaller and weaker, which is not a good thing because you need bones for protection. So as we get older, this process kind of happens in all of us, and it produces a pathological condition, and it's a really strange pathology in the following sense. For instance, if there is a cold or a flu, there's a cold going around right now, but are we all going to come down with that cold? No, because we're all different, right? And some of us are going to be more susceptible to that virus than others. So some will get the cold, some won't. Some might get the cold but be over it in a day. Some might get that same cold, but it might take 2 weeks to get over, right? Because we're all different. This is a really strange process because it will affect everybody in the population. As we grow older, those osteoclasts become a little bit more effective than the osteoblasts, and we lose bone mass. And does anybody know what the name of that process is called? That is called osteoporosis, right? So, how can you protect yourself from osteoporosis? Exercise, right? Diet and exercise. You need to have proper calcium in your diet and exercise so that that calcium ends up in your bones so that they stay strong. Some people are a little bit more susceptible to osteoporosis than others, typically females, and that's partially due to estrogen. Females don't have a lot of testosterone. Testosterone has a tendency to make bones thick and strong, so most males have bigger, thicker bones compared to the other females in their family, but some females have bigger, stronger bones just by their nature. They're more protected from osteoporosis as well. So your genetic makeup makes a big difference. But so women are a little bit more susceptible, but if you are a woman, what can you do to protect yourself from osteoporosis later on in life? Diet and exercise, right? Proper calcium and exercise. And if you have a thin bone structure, then you should really pay attention to that so that you get proper exercise before menopause, not post-menopausally. It doesn't work quite so well. All right, let's talk about bone repair for just the last couple remaining moments. All right, in that, what is the structural and functional unit of compact bone called again? Osteon. What's on the very center of that osteon? The central canal or Haversian canal, and what's inside there? Blood vessels. Yeah, a lot of blood vessels, right? So bone is highly vascular. So when you break a bone, one of the harmful effects of breaking that bone is hemorrhage, because you're going to be breaking blood vessels. And you can bleed to death, right, without proper care. But if it's not a major bone break, or if you have proper care, that broken blood vessel is going to form a blood clot, which will have a tendency to stabilize the bone fragments a little bit, but especially it will stop the bleeding from happening. Okay? But right after the bone is broken, then some fibroblasts move into the site of the fracture. And what does a fibroblast secrete? Fibers. Like what kind of fiber do you think would be good? Yeah, collagen, a nice strong fiber. So these fibroblasts get busy and they start to join these bone fragments together with collagen fibers so they don't move around, because bone fragments are very sharp. They act like little micro razor blades or knives inside there. So when you move that fracture, it can slice tissues up or make more damage to blood vessels. So those collagen fibers start to glue all the bone fragments together. And after the bone fragments are glued together with these collagen fibers, it's called a callus. Right, and that takes maybe 2 or 3 days to form. Right, and if that callus is formed and you don't disturb the callus until you have a nicely repaired bone, the bone is going to heal stronger than what it was before. But if you damage the callus after it is formed, then the bone is never going to grow back to where it was, and it's going to be a lot weaker. So what do we do to bones typically to get them, after they're fractured, to grow back properly? To protect them, to protect that callus that is not as strong as bone. It's just collagen fibers. Yeah, you put a cast on there in most cases, right, to protect those bones, reduce the mobility. All right, and then after the callus is formed, osteoblasts enter the callus. And what do osteoblasts do? They create bone, right? So now these osteoblasts create bone within the callus. Oh, but there's something else that happens before that. All those bone fragments are cleaned up. What kind of cell cleans up all those bone fragments? Because now you have bones, you got bone fragments in the part of your body where you don't want to have bone fragments. What gets rid of those bone fragments? The osteoclasts go to work, right? Then the osteoblasts move in, build more new bone, right? And after about 4 to 6 weeks, you've got a nice new bone that's even stronger than before. As long as you do what? You protect it, you don't harm that callus, right, when those osteoblasts are in there working. Okay, so those are the important concepts for the introductory chapter to bones. So next time, don't forget, you've got a test on those first 4 chapters. How are you doing in SI? Are you covering that stuff? Okay. Okay. Yeah. But as far as tissues and all that stuff, you guys are good. Okay. Okay. Oh, you got a holiday on Monday. So SI on Tuesday. That's good. Yeah, okay. SI on Tuesday.
I have it, not everybody.
Oh, you have ability to do that? Good. Okay. And here's the sign-in sheet. Thank you. Don't forget your sign-in sheet. Questions in it. Why is that?